They had no grasp, those apes, of how close they lay to a state where the devouring beasts of Earth's infancy would be little more than fleas. That state was called the Inovo, and on the other side of it lay four worlds, the so-called reconciled dominions. They teemed with wonders, individuals blessed with attributes that would have made them, in this, the fifth dominion, fit for sainthood or burning, or both. Cults possessed of secrets that would overturn in a moment the dogmas of faith and physics alike. Beauty that might blind the sun or set the moon dreaming of fertility. All this, separated from Earth, the unreconciled fifth, by the abyss of the Inovo. It was not, of course, an impossible journey to make, but the power to do so, which was usually and contemptuously referred to as magic, had been waning in the fifth since Chant had first arrived. He'd seen the walls of reason built against it, brick by brick. He'd seen its practitioners hounded and mocked, seen its theories decay into decadence and parody, seen its purpose steadily forgotten. The fifth was choking in its own certainties, and though he took no pleasure in the thought of losing his life, he would not mourn his removal from this hard and unpoetic dominion. He went to his window and looked down the five stories into the courtyard. It was empty. He had a few minutes yet to compose his missive to Esterbrook. Returning to his table, he began it again, for the ninth or tenth time. There was so much he wanted to communicate, but he knew that Esterbrook was utterly ignorant of the involvement of his family, whose name he'd abandoned, with the fate of the Dominions. It was too late now to educate him. A warning would have to suffice. But how to word it so it didn't sound like the rambling of a wild man? He set to again, putting the facts as plainly as he could, though doubting that these words would save Esterbrook's life. If the powers that prowled this world tonight wanted him dispatched, nothing short of intervention from the Unbeheld himself, Hapexamendios, the all-powerful occupant of the First Dominion, would save him. With the note finished, Chant pocketed it and headed out into the darkness. Not a moment too soon. In the frosty quiet he heard the sound of an engine too suave to belong to a resident, and peered over the parapet to see the men getting out of the car below. He didn't doubt that these were his visitors. The only vehicles he'd seen here so polished were hearses. He cursed himself. Fatigue had made him slothful, and now he'd let his enemies get dangerously close. He ducked down the back stairs, glad for once that there were so few lights working along the landings, as his visitors strode towards the front. From the flats he passed the sound of lives, Christmas pops on the radio, argument, a baby laughing, which became tears, as though it sensed there was danger near. Chant knew none of his neighbours, except as furtive faces glimpsed at windows, and now, though it was too late to change that, he regretted it. He reached ground level unharmed, and discounting the thought of trying to retrieve his car from the courtyard, he headed off towards the street most heavily trafficked at this time of night, which was Kennington Park Road. If he was lucky, he'd find a cab there, though at this time of night they weren't frequent. Fares were harder to pick up in this area than in Covent Garden or Oxford Street, and more likely to prove unruly. He allowed himself one backward glance, then turned his heels to the task of flight. 2. Though classically it was the light of day which showed a painter the deepest flaws in his handiwork, Gentle worked best at night. The instincts of a lover brought to a simpler art. In the week or so since he'd returned to his studio, it had once again become a place of work. The air pungent with the smell of paint and turpentine, the burned-down butts of cigarettes left on every available shelf and plate. Though he'd spoken with Klein daily, there was no sign of a commission yet. So he had spent the time re-educating himself. As Klein had so cruelly observed, he was a technician without a vision, and that made these days of meandering difficult. Until he had a style to forge, he felt listless, like some latter-day Adam born with the power to impersonate, but bereft of subjects. So he set himself an exercise. He would paint a canvas in four radically different styles, a cubist north, an impressionist south, an east after Van Gogh, a west after Dali. As his subject, he took Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus. The challenge drove him to a healthy distraction, and he was still occupied with it at 3:30 in the morning, when the telephone rang. The line was watery, and the voice at the other end pained and raw. But it was unmistakably Judith.
"Is that you, Gentle?"
"It's me."
He was glad the line was so bad. The sound of her voice had shaken him, and he didn't want her to know.
"Where are you calling from?"
"New York. I'm just visiting for a few days."
"It's good to hear from you."
"I'm not sure why I'm calling. It's just that today's been strange, and I thought maybe... Oh!"
She stopped, laughed at herself, perhaps a little drunkenly.
"I don't know what I thought," she went on. "It's stupid. I'm sorry."
"When are you coming back?"
"I don't know that either."
"Maybe we could get together."
"I don't think so, Gentle."
"Just to talk?"
"This line's getting worse. I'm sorry I woke you."
"You didn't."
"Keep warm, huh?
Judith."
"Sorry, Gentle."
The line went dead. But the water she'd spoken through gurgled on, like the noise in a seashell. Not the ocean at all, of course, just illusion. He put the receiver down and, knowing he'd never sleep now, squeezed out some fresh, bright worms of paint to work with, and set to. 3. It was the whistle from the gloom behind him that alerted Chant to the fact that his escape had not gone unnoticed. It was not a whistle that could have come from human lips, but a chilling scalpel shriek he had heard only once before in the Fifth Dominion, when, some 200 years past, his then-possessor, the Maestro Sartori, had conjured from the Inn Ovo a familiar which had made such a whistle. It had brought bloody tears to its summoner's eyes, obliging Sartori to relinquish it post-haste. Later, Chant and the Maestro had spoken of the event, and Chant had identified the creature. It was known in the reconciled dominions as a voider, one of a brutal species that haunted the wastes north of the Lenten Way. Voiders came in many shapes, being made, some said, from collective desire, which fact seemed to move Sartori profoundly. "I must summon one again," he'd said, "and speak with it." To which Chant had replied that if they were to attempt such a summoning, they had to be ready next time, for voiders were lethal and could not be tamed except by maestros of inordinate power. The proposed conjuring had never taken place. Sartori had disappeared a short time later. In all the intervening years, Chant had wondered if he had attempted a second summoning alone and been the voider's victim. Perhaps the creature now coming after Chant had been responsible. Though Sartori had disappeared 200 years ago, the lives of voiders, like those of so many species from the other dominions, were longer than the longest human span. Chant glanced over his shoulder. The whistler was in sight. It looked perfectly human, dressed in a grey, well-cut suit and black tie, its collar turned up against the cold, its hands thrust into its pockets. It didn't run, but almost idled as it came, the whistle confounding Chant's thoughts and making him stumble. As he turned away, the second of his pursuers appeared on the pavement in front of him, drawing a hand from its pocket. A gun? No. A knife? No. Something tiny crawled in the voider's palm, like a flea. Chant had no sooner focused upon it than it leapt towards his face. Repulsed, he raised his arm to keep it from his eyes or mouth, and the flea landed upon his hand. He slapped at it with his other hand, but it was beneath his thumbnail before he could get to it. He raised his arm to see its motion in the flesh of his thumb, and clamped his other hand around the base of the digit in the hope of stopping its further advance, gasping as though doused with ice water. The pain was out of all proportion to the mite's size, but he held both thumb and sobs hard, determined not to lose all dignity in front of his executioners. Then he staggered off the pavement into the street, throwing a glance down towards the brighter lights at the junction. What safety they offered was debatable, but if worst came to worst, he would throw himself beneath a car and deny the voiders the entertainment of his slow demise. He began to run again, still clutching his hand. This time he didn't glance back. He didn't need to. The sound of the whistling faded and the purr of the car replaced it. He threw every ounce of his energy into the run, reaching the bright street to find it deserted by traffic. He turned north, racing past the underground station towards the Elephant and Castle. Now he did glance behind to see the car following steadily. It had three occupants, the voiders and another sitting in the back seat. Sobbing with breathlessness, he ran on, and, Lord love it, a taxi appeared around the next corner, its yellow light announcing its availability. Concealing his pain as best he could, knowing the driver might pass on by if he thought the hailer was wounded, he stepped out into the street and raised his hand to wave the driver down. This meant unclasping one hand from the other, and the mite took instant advantage, working its way up into his wrist. But the vehicle slowed.
Where to, mate?
He astonished himself with the reply, giving not Esterbrook's address, but that of another place entirely.
Clerkenwell, he said. Gamut Street.
Don't know it,
the cabby replied, and for one heart-stopping moment Chant thought he was going to drive on.
I'll direct you,
he said.
Get in, then.
Chant did so, slamming the cab door with no little satisfaction and barely managing to reach the seat before the cab picked up speed. Why had he named Gamut Street? There was nothing there that would heal him. Nothing could. The flea, or whatever variation in that species it was that crawled in him, had reached his elbow, and his arm below that pain was now completely numb, the skin of his hand wrinkled and flaky. But the house in Gamut Street had been a place of miracles once. Men and women of great authority had walked in it, and perhaps left some ghost of themselves to calm him in extremis. No creature, Sartori had taught, passed through this dominion unrecorded, even to the least, to the child that perished a heartbeat after it opened its eyes, the child that died in the womb, drowned in its mother's waters. Even that unnamed thing had its record and its consequence. So how much more might the once powerful of Gamut Street have left by way of echoes? His heart was palpitating, and his body full of jitters. Fearing he'd soon lose control of his functions, he pulled the letter to Esterbrook from his pocket and leaned forward to slide the half-window between himself and the driver aside.
When you've dropped me in Clerkenwell, I'd like you to deliver a letter for me. Would you be so kind?
Sorry, mate, the driver said. I'm going home after this. I've a wife waiting for me.
Chant dug in his inside pocket and pulled out his wallet, then passed it through the window, letting it drop on the seat beside the driver.
Who's this? All the money I've got. This letter has to be delivered.
All the money you've got, eh?
The driver picked up the wallet and flicked it open, his gaze going between its contents and the road.
There's a lot of dosh in here. Have it? It's no good to me. Are you sick?
And tired, Chant said.
Take it, why don't you? Enjoy it.
There's a Daimler been following us. Somebody you know?
There was no purpose served by lying to the man.
Yes, Chant said. I don't suppose you could put some distance between them and us?
The man pocketed the wallet and jabbed his foot down on the accelerator. The cab leapt forward like a racehorse from the gate, its jockey's laugh rising above the guttural din of the engine. Whether it was the cash he was now heavy with or the challenge of outrunning a Daimler that motivated him, he put his cab through its paces, proving it more mobile than its bulk would have suggested. And under a minute they'd made two sharp lefts and a squealing right, and were roaring down a back street so narrow the least miscalculation would have taken off handles, hubs, and mirrors. The mazing didn't stop there. They made another turn, and another, bringing them in a short time to Southwark Bridge. Somewhere along the way they'd lost the Daimler. Chant might have applauded, had he possessed two workable hands. But the flea's message of corruption was spreading with agonizing speed. While he still had five fingers under his command, he went back to the window and dropped Esterbrook's letter through, murmuring the address with a tongue that felt disfigured in his mouth.
"What's wrong with you?" the cabbie said. "It's not fucking contagious, is it? 'Cause if it is..."
"Not,"
Chant said.
"You look fucking awful,"
the cabbie said, glancing in the mirror.
"Sure you don't want a hospital?"
"No.
Gamut Street. I want Gamut Street. You'll have to direct me from here."
The streets had all changed. Trees gone, rows demolished, austerity in place of elegance, function in place of beauty, the new for old, however poor the exchange rate. It was a decade and more since he'd come here last. Had Gamut Street fallen, and a steel phallus risen in its place?
"Where are we?" he asked the driver. "Clerkenwell. That's where you want it, isn't it? I mean the precise place."
The driver looked for a sign.
"Flaxon Street. Does it ring a bell?"
Chant peered out of the window.
"Yes, yes, go down to the end and turn right. Used to live around here, did you?" "A long time ago." "It's seen better days."
He turned right.
"Now where?"
"First on the left."
"Here it is," the man said. "Gamut Street. What number was it?"
28. The cab drew up at the curb. Chant fumbled for the handle, opened the door, and all but fell out onto the pavement. Staggering, he put his weight against the door to close it, and for the first time, he and the driver came face to face. Whatever the flea was doing to his system, it must have been horribly apparent, to judge by the look of repugnance on the man's face.
"You will deliver the letter?" Chant said. "You can trust me, mate."
"When you've done it?"
"You should go home," Chant said. "Tell your wife you love her. Give a prayer of thanks."
"What for?"
"That you're human," Chant said.
The cabbie didn't question this little lunacy.
"Whatever you say, mate," he replied. "I'll give the missus one and give thanks at the same time, how's that? Now don't do anything I wouldn't do, eh?"
This advice given, he drove off, leaving his passenger to the silence of the street. With failing eyes, Chant scanned the gloom. The houses, built in the middle of Sartori's century, looked to be mostly deserted, primed for demolition, perhaps. But then Chant knew that sacred places, and Gamut Street was sacred in its way, survived on occasion because they went unseen, even in plain sight. Burnished by magic, they deflected the threatening eye and found unwitting allies in men and women who, all unknowing, knew holiness, became sanctuaries for a secret few. He climbed the three steps to the door and pushed at it, but it was securely locked, so he went to the nearest window. There was a filthy shroud of cobweb across it, but no curtain beyond. He pressed his face to the glass. Though his eyes were weakening by the moment, his gaze was still more acute than that of the blossoming ape. The room he looked into was stripped of all furniture and decoration. If anybody had occupied this house since Sartori's time, and it surely hadn't stood empty for 200 years, they had gone, taking every trace of their presence. He raised his good arm and struck the glass with his elbow, a single jab which shattered the window. Then, careless of the damage he did himself, he hoisted his bulk onto the sill, beat out the rest of the pieces of glass with his hand, and dropped down into the room on the other side. The layout of the house was still clear in his mind. In dreams, he drifted through these rooms and heard the maestro's voice summoning him up the stairs, up, up, to the room at the top, where Sartori had worked his work. It was there Chant wanted to go now, but there were new signs of atrophy in his body with every heartbeat. The hand first invaded by the flea was withered, its nails dropped from their place, its bone showing at the knuckles and wrist. Beneath his jacket he knew his torso to the hip was similarly unmade. He felt pieces of his flesh falling inside his shirt as he moved. He would not be moving for much longer. His legs were increasingly unwilling to bear him up, and his senses were close to flickering out. Like a man whose children were leaving him, he begged as he climbed the stairs.
"Stay with me. Just a little longer. Please."
His cajoling got him as far as the first landing, but then his legs all but gave out, and thereafter he had to climb using his one good arm to haul him onward. He was halfway up the final flight when he heard the voider's whistle in the street outside, its piercing din unmistakable. They had found him quicker than he'd anticipated, sniffing him out through the darkened streets. The fear that he'd be denied sight of the sanctum at the top of the stairs spurred him on, his body doing its ragged best to accommodate his ambition. From below, he heard the door being forced open, then the whistle again, harder than before, as his pursuers stepped into the house. He began to berate his limbs, his tongue barely able to shape the words.
"Don't let me down! Work, will you? Work!"
And they obliged. He scaled the last few stairs in a spastic fashion, but reached the top flight as he heard the voider's soles at the bottom. It was dark up here, though how much of that was blindness and how much night he didn't know. It scarcely mattered. The route to the door of the sanctum was as familiar to him as the limbs he'd lost. He crawled on hands and knees across the landing, the ancient boards creaking beneath him. A sudden fear seized him, that the door would be locked and he'd beat his weakness against it and fail to gain access. He reached up for the handle, grasped it, tried to turn it once, failed, tried again, and this time dropped face down over the threshold as the door swung open. There was food for his enfeebled eyes. Shafts of moonlight spilled from the windows in the roof. Though he dimly thought it was sentiment that had driven him back here, he saw now it was not. In returning here, he came full circle, back to the room which had been his first glimpse of the Fifth Dominion. This was his cradle and his tutoring room. Here he'd smelled the air of England for the first time, the crisp October air. Here he'd fed first, drunk first, first had cause for laughter, and, later, for tears. Unlike the lower rooms, whose emptiness was a sign of desertion, this space had always been sparely furnished, and sometimes completely empty. He'd danced here on the same legs that now lay dead beneath him, while Sartori had told him how he planned to take this wretched dominion and build in its midst a city that would shame Babylon. Danced for sheer exuberance, knowing his maestro was a great man and had it in his power to change the world. Lost ambition. All lost. Before that October had become November, Sartori had gone, flitted in the night or murdered by his enemies, gone, and left his servant stranded in a city he barely knew. How Chant had longed then to return to the ether from where he'd been summoned, to shrug off the body which Sartori had congealed around him and be gone out of this dominion. But the only voice capable of ordering such a release was that which had conjured him, and with Sartori gone he was exiled on Earth forever. He hadn't hated his summoner for that. Sartori had been indulgent for the weeks they'd been together. Were he to appear now, in the moonlit room, Chant would not have accused him of negligence, but made proper obeisances, and been glad that his inspiration had returned.
"Maestro,"
he murmured, face to the musty boards.
"Not here," came a voice from behind him. It was not, he knew, one of the voiders. They could whistle but not speak. "You were Sartori's creature, were you? I don't remember that."
The speaker was precise, cautious and smug. Unable to turn, Chant had to wait until the man walked past his supine body to get a sight of him. He knew better than to judge by appearances. He, whose flesh was not his own but of the maestro's sculpting. Though the man in front of him looked human enough, he had the voiders in tow and spoke with knowledge of things few humans had access to. His face was an overripe cheese, drooping with jowls and weary folds around the eyes, his expression that of a funereal comic. The smugness in his voice was here too, in the studied way he licked upper and lower lips with his tongue before he spoke, and tapped the fingertips of each hand together as he judged the broken man at his feet. He wore an immaculately tailored three-piece suit, cut from a cloth of apricot cream. Chant would have given a good deal to break the bastard's nose, so he bled on it.
"I never did meet Sartori," he said. "Whatever happened to him?"
The man went down on his haunches in front of Chant and suddenly snatched hold of a handful of his hair.
"I asked you what happened to your maestro," he said. "I'm Dowd, by the way. You never knew my master, the Lord Godolphin, and I never knew yours. But they're gone, and you're scrabbling around for work. Well, you won't have to do it any longer, if you take my meaning."
Did you send him to me?"
"It would help my comprehension if you could be more specific."
"Estabrook,"
Oh, yes, Kim.
You dead? Why?
Wheels within wheels, my dove, Dowd said. I tell you the whole bitter story, but you don't have the time to listen, and I don't have the patience to explain. I knew of a man who needed an assassin. I knew of another man who dealt in them. Let's leave it at that.
But how did you know about me?
You're not discreet, Dowd replied. You get drunk on the Queen's birthday, and you gab like an Irishman at a wake. Lovey, it draws attention sooner or later.
Once in a while?
I know you get melancholy. We all do, lovey, we all do. But some of us do our weeping in private. And some of us, he let Chance's head drop, make fucking public spectacles of ourselves. There are consequences, lovey. Didn't Sartori tell you that? There are always consequences. You've begun something with this Estabrook business, for instance, and I'll need to watch it closely, or before we know it there'll be ripples spreading through the Imagica.
The Imagica?
That's right. From here to the margin of the First Dominion, to the region of the Unbeheld himself. Chant began to gasp, and Dowd, realizing he'd hit a nerve, leaned towards his victim. "Do I detect a little anxiety?" he said. "Are you afraid of going into the glory of our Lord Hapex Amendios?" Chant's voice was frail now.
"Yes,"
he murmured. "Why?" Dowd wanted to know. "Because of your crimes?"
"Yes."
What are your crimes? Do tell me. We needn't bother with the little things, just the really shameful stuff'll do.
I've had dealings with a Yerhetemic.
Have you indeed? Dowd said. However did you get back to Isorderex to do that?
I didn't, Chant replied. My dealings were here in the Fifth.
Really? Said Dowd softly. I didn't know there were Yerhetemics here. You learn something new every day. But, lovey, that's no great crime. The Unbeheld is going to forgive a poxy little trespass like that. Unless... He stopped for a moment, turning over a new possibility. Unless the Yerhetemic was a mischief. He trailed the thought, but Chant remained silent. "Oh, my dove," Dowd said. "It wasn't, was it?" Another pause. "Oh, it was! It was!" He sounded almost enchanted. "There's a mischief in the Fifth, and—" "What? You're in love with it? You'd better tell me before you run out of breath, lovey. In a few minutes your eternal soul will be waiting at Hapex Amendios's door." Chant shuddered.
"The assassin," he said.
"What about the assassin?" came the reply. Then, realizing what he'd just heard, Dowd drew a long, slow breath. "The assassin is a mischief?" he said.
"Yes."
"Oh, my sweet hire!" he exclaimed. "A mischief!" The enchantment had vanished from his voice now. He was hard and dry. "Do you know what they can do? The deceits they've got at their disposal? This was supposed to be an anonymous piece of shit-stirring, and look what you've done!" His voice softened again. "Was it beautiful?" he asked. "No, no, don't tell me. Let me have the surprise when I see it face to face." He turned to the voiders. "Pick the fucker up," he said. They stepped forward and raised Chant by his broken arms. There was no strength left in his neck, and his head lolled forward, a solid stream of bilious fluid running from his mouth and nostrils. "How often does the Yerhetemic tribe produce a mischief?" Dowd mused, half to himself. "Every 10 years? Every 50? They're certainly rare. And there you are, blithely hiring one of these little divinities as an assassin. Imagine! How pitiful that it had fallen so low! I must ask it how that came about." He stepped towards Chant, and at Dowd's order,
One of the voiders raised Chan's head by the hair.
I need the mistiff's whereabouts, Dowd said, and its name.
Chant sobbed through his bile.
Please, he said. I meant...
Yes, yes, no harm. You were just doing your duty. The unbeheld will forgive you, I guarantee it. But the mischief, lovey, I need you to tell me about the mischief. Where can I find it? Just speak the words and you won't ever have to think about it again. You'll go into the presence of the unbeheld like a babe.
I will.
You will. Trust me. Just give me its name and tell me the place where I can find it.
Name and place.
That's right. But get to it, lovey, before it's too late.
Chant took as deep a breath as his collapsing lungs allowed.
It's called Pai-O-Pa, he said.
Dowd stepped back from the dying man as if slapped.
Pai-O-Pa? Are you sure?
I'm sure.
Pai-O-Pa is alive? And Estabrook hired it?
Yes.
Dowd threw off his imitation of a father confessor and murmured a fretful question of himself.
What does this mean?
He said. Chant made a pained little moan, his system racked by further waves of dissolution. Realizing that time was now very short, Dowd pressed the man afresh.
Where is this mischief? Quickly now! Quickly!
Chant's face was decaying, cobs of withered flesh sliding off the slickened bone. When he answered, it was with half a mouth, but answer he did, to be unburdened.
I thank you, Dowd said to him, when all the information had been supplied. I thank you.
Then to the voiders,
let him go.
They dropped Chant without ceremony. When he hit the floor, his face broke, pieces spattering Dowd's shoe. He viewed the mess with disgust.
Clean it off, he said.
The voiders were at his feet in moments, dutifully removing the scraps of matter from Dowd's handmade shoes.
What does this mean? Dowd murmured again.
There was surely synchronicity in this turn of events. In a little over half a year's time, the anniversary of the reconciliation would be upon the Imagica. 200 years would have passed since the Maestro Sartori had attempted, and failed, to perform the greatest act of magic known to this or any other dominion. The plans for that ceremony had been laid here, at number 28 Gamut Street, and the mischief, among others, had been there to witness the preparations. The ambition of those heady days had ended in tragedy, of course. Rites intended to heal the rift in the Imagica and reconcile the Fifth Dominion with the other four had gone disastrously awry. Many great theurgists, shamans, and theologians had been killed. Determined that such a calamity never be repeated, several of the survivors had banded together in order to cleanse the Fifth of all magical knowledge. But however much they scrubbed to erase the past, the slate could never be entirely cleansed. Traces of what had been dreamed and hoped for remained, fragments of Poems to Union written by men whose names had been systematically removed from all record. And as long as such scraps remained, the spirit of the reconciliation would survive. But spirit was not enough. A maestro was needed, a magician arrogant enough to believe that he could succeed where Christos and innumerable other sorcerers most lost to history had failed. Though these were blissless times, Dowd didn't discount the possibility of such a soul appearing. He still encountered in his daily life a few who looked past the empty gourd that distracted lesser minds and longed for a revelation that would burn the tinsel away, an apocalypse that would show the Fifth the glories it yearned for in its sleep. If a maestro was going to appear, however, he would need to be swift. Another attempt at reconciliation couldn't be planned overnight, and if the next midsummer went unused, the Imagica would pass another 2 centuries divided. Time enough for the Fifth Dominion to destroy itself out of boredom or frustration, and prevent the reconciliation from ever taking place. Dowd perused his newly polished shoes.
Perfect, he said. Which is more than I can say for the rest of this wretched world.
He crossed to the door. The voiders lingered by the body, however, bright enough to know they still had some duty to perform with it. but Dowd called them away.
"We'll leave it here," he said. "Who knows? It may stir a few ghosts."
Chapter 5 1 2 days after the pre-dawn call from Judith, days in which the water heater in the studio had failed, leaving Gentle the option of bathing in polar waters, or not at all, he chose the latter, Klein summoned him to the house. He had good news. He'd heard of a buyer with a hunger that was not being satisfied through conventional markets, and Klein had allowed it to be known that he might be able to lay his hands on something attractive. Gentle had successfully recreated one Gauguin previously, a small picture which had gone onto the open market and been consumed without any questions being asked. Could he do it again? Gentle replied that he would make a Gauguin so fine the artist himself would have wept to see it. Klein advanced Gentle £500 to pay the rent on the studio and left him to it, remarking only that Gentle was looking a good deal better than he'd looked previously, though he smelled a good deal worse. Gentle didn't much care. Not bathing for 2 days was no great inconvenience when he only had himself for company. Not shaving suited him fine when there was no woman to complain of beard burns. And he'd rediscovered the old private erotics, spit, palm, and fantasy. It sufficed. A man might get used to living this way, might get to like his gut a little ample, his armpits sweaty, his balls the same. It wasn't until the weekend that he started to pine for some entertainment other than the sight of himself in the bathroom mirror. There hadn't been a Friday or Saturday in the last year which hadn't been occupied by some social gathering where he'd mingled with Vanessa's friends. Their numbers were still listed in his address book, just a phone call away. But he felt squeamish about making contact. However much he may have charmed them, they were her friends, not his, and they'd have inevitably sided with her in this fiasco. As for his own peers, the friends he'd had before Vanessa, most had faded. They were a part of his past and, like so many other memories, slippery. While people like Klein recalled events 30 years old in crystalline detail, Gentle had difficulty remembering where he was and with whom even 10 years before. Earlier than that still, and his memory banks were empty. It was as though his mind was disposed only to preserve enough details of his history to make the present plausible. The rest it disregarded. He kept this strange fallibility from almost everybody he knew, concocting details if pressed hard. It didn't much bother him. Not knowing what it meant to have a past, he didn't miss it, and he construed from exchanges with others that though they might talk confidently about their childhood and adolescence, much of it was rumour and conjecture, some of it pure fabrication. Nor was he alone in his ignorance. Judith had once confided that she too had an uncertain grasp of the past, though she'd been drunk at the time and had denied it vehemently when he'd raised the subject again. So, between friends lost and friends forgotten, he was very much alone this Saturday night, and he picked up the phone when it rang with some gratitude. "Fury here," he said. He felt like a fury tonight. The line was live, but there was no answer. "Who's there?" he said. Still. Silence. Irritated, he put down the receiver. Seconds later, the phone rang again. "Who the hell is this?" he demanded. And this time, an impeccably spoken man replied, albeit with another question. "Am I speaking to John Zacharias?" Gentle didn't hear himself called that too often. "Who is this?" he said again. "We've only met once. You probably don't remember me. Charles Estabrook." Some people lingered longer in the memory than others. Estabrook was one. The man who'd caught Jude when she'd dropped from the high wire. A classic inbred Englishman, member of the minor aristocracy. Pompous, condescending, and, "I'd like very much to meet with you, if that's possible."
"I don't think we've got anything to say to each other."
"It's about Judith, Mr. Zacharias. A matter I'm obliged to keep in the strictest confidence, but is, I cannot stress too strongly, of the profoundest importance." The tortured syntax made Gentle blunt.
Spit it out, then, he said.
Not on the telephone. I realize this request comes without warning, but I beg you to consider it.
I have. And no, I'm not interested in meeting you.
Even to gloat?
Over what?
Over the fact that I've lost her, Estabrook said. She left me, Mr. Zacharias, just as she left you, 33 days ago.
The precision of that spoke volumes. Was he counting the hours as well as the days? Perhaps the minutes, too.
You needn't come to the house if you don't wish to. In fact, to be honest, I'd be happier if you didn't.
He was speaking as if Gentle would agree to the rendezvous, which, though he hadn't said so yet, he would. 2. It was cruel, of course, to bring someone of Estabrook's age out on a cold day and make him climb a hill, but Gentle knew from experience you took whatever satisfactions you could along the way. And Parliament Hill had a fine view of London, even on a day of lowering cloud. The wind was brisk, and as usual on a Sunday, the hill had a host of kite flyers on its back, their toys like multicoloured candies suspended in the wintry sky. The hike made Estabrook breathless, but he seemed glad that Gentle had picked the spot.
I haven't been up here in years. My first wife used to like coming here to see the kites.
He brought a brandy flask from his pocket, proffering it first to Gentle. Gentle declined.
The cold never leaves one's marrow these days. One of the penalties of age. I've yet to discover the advantages. How old are you?
Rather than confess to not knowing, Gentle said, almost 40.
You look younger. In fact, you've scarcely changed since we first met. Do you remember? At the auction. You were with her. I wasn't. That was the world of difference between us. Without. I envied you that day the way I'd never envied any other man, just for having her beside you. Later, of course, I saw the same look on other men's faces.
I didn't come here to hear this, Gentle said.
No, I realize that. It's just necessary for me to express how very precious she was to me. I count the years I had with her as the best of my life. But of course the best can't go on forever, can they? Or how are they the best?
He drank again.
You know, she never talked about you, he said. I tried to provoke her into doing so, but she said she'd put you out of her mind completely. She'd forgotten you, she said. Which is nonsense, of course.
I believe it.
Don't, Estabrook said quickly. You were her guilty secret.
Why are you trying to flatter me?
It's the truth. She still loved you all through the time she was with me. That's why we're talking now. Because I know it, and I think you do too.
Not once so far had they mentioned her by name, almost as though from some superstition. She was she, her, the woman, an absolute and invisible power. Her men seemed to have their feet on solid ground, but in truth they drifted like the kites, tethered to reality only by the memory of her.
I've done a terrible thing, John, Estabrook said.
The flask was at his lips again. He took several gulps before sealing it and pocketing it.
And I regret it bitterly.
What?
May we walk a little way?
Estabrook said, glancing towards the kite flyers, who were both too distant and too involved in their sport to be eavesdropping. But he was not comfortable with sharing his secret until he'd put twice the distance between his confession and their ears. When he had, he made it simply and plainly.
I don't know what kind of madness overtook me, he said, but a little while ago I made a contract with somebody to have her killed.
You did what?
Does it appall you?
What do you think? Of course it appalls me.
It's the highest form of devotion, you know, to want to end somebody's existence, rather than let them live on without you. It's love of the highest order.
It's a fucking obscenity.
Oh, yes, it's that, too. But I couldn't bear. Just couldn't bear the idea of her being alive and me not being with her.
His delivery was now deteriorating, the words becoming tears.
She was so dear to me.
Gentle's thoughts were of his last exchange with Judith, the half-drowned telephone call from New York, which had ended with nothing said. Had she known then that her life was in jeopardy? If not, did she now? My God, was she even alive? He took hold of Esther Brooke's lapel with the same force that the fear took hold of him.
You haven't brought me here to tell me she's dead.
No, no,
he protested, making no attempt to disengage Gentle's hold.
I hired this man, and I want to call him off.
So do it,
Gentle said, letting the coat go.
I can't.
Esterbrook reached into his pocket and pulled out a sheet of paper. To judge by its crumpled state, it had been thrown away, then reclaimed.
This came from the man who found me the assassin, he went on. It was delivered to my home 2 nights ago. He was obviously drunk or drugged when he wrote it, but it indicates that he expects to be dead by the time I read it. I'm assuming he's correct. He hasn't made contact. He was my only route to the assassin.
Where did you meet this man?
He found me.
And the assassin?
I met him somewhere south of the river. I don't know where. It was dark. I was lost. Besides, he won't be there. He's gone after her.
So warn her.
I've tried. She won't accept my calls. She's got another lover now. He's being covetous the way I was. My letters, my telegrams, they're all sent back unopened. But he won't be able to save her. This man I hired, his name's Pi.
What's that? Some kind of code?
I don't know, Esterbrook said. I don't know anything except I've done something unforgivable, and you have to help me undo it. You have to. This man Pi is lethal.
What makes you think she'll see me when she won't see you?
There's no guarantee. But you're a younger, fitter man, and you've had some experience of the criminal mind. You've a better chance of coming between her and Pi than I have. I'll give you money for the assassin, you can pay him off, and I'll pay whatever you ask. I'm rich. Just warn her, Zacharias, and get her to come home. I can't have her death on my conscience.
It's a little late to think about that.
I'm making what amends I can. Do we have a deal?
He took off his leather glove in preparation for shaking Gentle's hand.
I'd like the letter from your contact, Gentle said.
It barely makes any sense, Esterbrook said.
If he is dead, and she dies too, that letter's evidence whether it makes sense or not. Hand it over, or no deal.
Esterbrook reached into his inside pocket as if to pull out the letter, but with his fingers upon it he hesitated. Despite all his talk about having a clear conscience, about Gentle being the man to save her, he was deeply reluctant to part with the letter.
I thought so, Gentle said. You want to make sure I look like the guilty party if anything goes wrong? Well, go fuck yourself.
He turned from Esterbrook and started down the hill. Esterbrook came after him, calling his name, but Gentle didn't slow his pace. He let the man run.
All right, he heard behind him. All right, have it. Have it!
Gentle slowed but didn't stop. Grey with exertion, Esterbrook caught up with him.
The letter's yours, he said.
Gentle took it, pocketing it without unfolding it. There'd be plenty of time to study it on the flight.
Chapter 6 1 Chant's body was discovered the following day by 93-year-old Albert Burke, who found it while looking for his errant mongrel kipper. The animal had sniffed from the street what its owner only began to nose as he climbed the stairs, whistling for his hound between curses, the rotting tissue at the top. In the autumn of 1916, Albert had fought for his country at the Somme, sharing trenches with dead companions for days at a time. The sights and smells of death didn't much distress him. Indeed, his sanguine response to his discovery lent colour to the story when it reached the evening news and assured it of greater coverage than it might otherwise have merited, that focus in turn bringing a penetrating eye to bear on the identity of the dead man.
Within a day a portrait of the deceased as he might have looked in life had been produced, and by Wednesday a woman living on a council estate south of the river had identified him as her next-door neighbour, Mr. Chant. An examination of his flat turned up a second picture, not of Chant's flesh this time, but of his life. It was the conclusion of the police that the dead man was a practitioner of some obscure religion. It was reported that a small altar dominated his room, decorated with the withered heads of animals that forensics could not identify. Its centrepiece, an idol of so explicitly sexual a nature, no newspaper dared publish a sketch of it, let alone a photograph. The gutter press particularly enjoyed the story, especially as the artifacts had belonged to a man now thought to have been murdered. They editorialized, with barely concealed racism, on the influx of perverted foreign religions. Between this and stories on Burke of the Somme, Chant's death attracted a lot of column inches. That fact had several consequences. It brought a rash of right-wing attacks on mosques in Greater London. It brought a call for the demolition of the estate where Chant had lived. And it brought Dowd up to a certain tower in Highgate, where he was summoned in lieu of his absentee master, Estabrook's brother, Oscar Godolphin. 2. In the 1780s, when Highgate Hill was so steep and deeply rutted that carriages regularly failed to make the grade and the drive to town was sufficiently dangerous that a wise man went with pistols, a merchant called Thomas Roxburgh had constructed a handsome house on Hornsey Lane, designed for him by one Henry Holland. At that time it had commanded fine views, south all the way to the river, north and west over the lush pastures of the region towards the tiny village of Hampstead. The former view was still available to the tourist, from the bridge that spanned the Archway Road, but Roxburgh's fine house had gone, replaced in the late 30s with an anonymous 10-story tower set back from the street. There was a screen of well-tended trees between tower and road, not sufficiently thick to conceal the building entirely, but enough to render what was already an undistinguished building virtually invisible. The only mail that was delivered there was circulars and official paperwork of one kind or another. There were no tenants, either individuals or businesses, yet Roxburgh Tower was kept well by its owners, who once every month or so gathered in the single room which occupied the top floor of the building, in the name of the man who had owned this plot of land 200 years before, and who had left it to the society he founded. The men and women, 11 in all, who met here and talked for a few hours and went their unremarkable ways, were the descendants of the impassioned few Roxburgh had gathered around him in the dark days following the failure of the reconciliation. There was no passion among them now, nor more than a vague comprehension of Roxburgh's purpose, in forming what he'd called the Society of the Tabula Rasa, or the Clean Slate. But they met anyway, in part because in their early childhood one or other of the parents, usually but not always the father, had taken them aside and told them a great responsibility would fall to them, the carrying forward of a hermetically protected family secret, and in part because the society looked after its own. Roxburgh had been a man of wealth and insight. He'd purchased considerable tracts of land during his lifetime, and the profits that accrued from that investment had ballooned as London grew. The sole recipient of those monies was the society. Though the funds were so ingeniously routed, through companies and agents who were unaware of their place in the system, that nobody who serviced the society in any capacity whatsoever knew of its existence. Thus, the Tabula Rasa flourished in its peculiar, purposeless way, gathering to talk about the secrets it kept, as Roxburgh had decreed, and enjoying the sight of the city from its place on Highgate Hill. Cutner Dowd had been here several times, though never when the society was assembled as it was tonight. His employer, Oscar Godolphin, was one of the 11 to whom the flame of Roxburgh's intent had been passed, though of all of them, surely none was so perfect a hypocrite as Godolphin, who was both a member of a society committed to the repression of all magical activity, and the employer, Godolphin would have said owner, of a creature summoned by magic in the very year of the tragedy that had brought the society into being. That creature was, of course, Dowd, whose existence was known to the Society's members, but whose origins were not. If it had been, they would never have summoned him here and allowed him access to the hallowed tower. Rather, they would have been bound by Roxburgh's edict to destroy him at whatever cost to their bodies, souls, or sanity that might entail. Certainly they had the expertise, or at least the means to gain it. The tower reputedly housed a library of treatises, grimoires, cyclopedias, and symposia second to none, collected by Roxburgh and the group of Fifth Dominion Magi who'd first supported the attempt at the reconciliation. One of those men had been Joshua Godolphin, Earl of Bellingham. He and Roxburgh had survived the calamitous events of that midsummer almost 200 years ago, but most of their dearest friends had not. The story went that after the tragedy, Godolphin had retired to his country estate and never again ventured beyond its perimeters. Roxburgh, on the other hand, ever the most pragmatic of the group, had within days of the cataclysm secured the occult libraries of his dead colleagues, hiding the thousands of volumes in the cellar of his house where they could, in the words of a letter to the Earl, no longer taint with unchristian ambition the minds of good men like our dear friends. We must hereafter keep the doing of this damnable magic from our shores. That he had not destroyed the books, but merely locked them away, was testament to some ambiguity in him, however. Despite the horrors he'd seen and the fierceness of his revulsion, some small part of him retained the fascination that had drawn him, Godolphin, and their fellow experimenters together in the first place. Dowd shivered with unease as he stood in the plain hallway of the tower, knowing that somewhere nearby was the largest collection of magical writings gathered in one place outside the Vatican, and that among them would be many rituals for the raising and dispatching of creatures like himself. He was not the conventional stuff of which familiars were made, of course. Most were simpering, mindless functionaries, plucked by their summoners from the In Ovo, the space between the Fifth and the Reconciled Dominions, like lobsters from a restaurant tank. He, on the other hand, had been a professional actor in his time, and feted for it. It wasn't congenital stupidity that had made him susceptible to human jurisdiction, it was anguish. He'd seen the face of Hapaxamendios himself, and, half-crazed by the sight, had been unable to resist the summons and the binding when it came. His invoker had, of course, been Joshua Godolphin, and he'd commanded Dowd to serve his line until the end of time. In fact, Joshua's retirement to the safety of his estate had freed Dowd to wander until the old man's demise, when he was drawn back to offer his services to Joshua's son, Nathaniel, only revealing his true nature once he'd made himself indispensable, for fear he was trapped between his bounden duty and the zeal of a Christian. In fact, Nathaniel had grown into a dissolute of considerable proportions by the time Dowd entered his employ, and could not have cared less what kind of creature Dowd was, as long as he procured the right kind of company. And so it had gone on, generation after generation, Dowd changing his face on occasion, a simple trick or fate, so as to conceal his longevity from the withering human world. But the possibility that one day his double-dealing would be discovered by the tabula rasa, and they would search through their library and find some vicious sway to destroy him, never entirely left his calculations, especially now, waiting for the call into their presence. That call was an hour and a half in coming, during which time he distracted himself, thinking about the shows that were opening in the coming week. Theatre remained his great love, and there was scarcely a production of any significance he failed to see. On the following Tuesday, he had tickets for the much-acclaimed Lear at the National, and then, 2 days later, a seat in the stalls for the revival of Turandot at the Colosseum. Much to look forward to, once this wretched interview was over. At last the lift hummed into life, and one of the Society's younger members, Giles Bloxham, appeared. At 40, Bloxham looked twice that age. It took a kind of genius, Godolphin had once remarked, when talking about Bloxham. He liked to report on the absurdities of the Society, particularly when he was in his cups, to look so dissipated and have nothing to regret for it.
We're ready for you now,
Bloxham said, indicating that Dowd should join him in the lift.
You realize, he said as they ascended, that if you're ever tempted to breathe a word of what you see here, the society will eradicate you so quickly and so thoroughly your mother won't even know you existed.
This overheated threat sounded ludicrous, delivered in Bloxham's nasal whine. But Dowd played the chastened functionary.
I perfectly understand, he said. It's an extraordinary step, Bloxham continued, calling anyone who isn't a member to a meeting. But these are extraordinary times. Not that it's any of your business.
Quite so, Dowd said, all innocence. Tonight he'd take their condescension without argument, he thought, more confident by the day that something was coming that would rock this tower to its foundations. When it did, he'd have his revenge. The lift door opened, and Bloxham ordered Dowd to follow him. The passages that led to the main suite were stark and uncarpeted. The room he was led into, the same. The drapes were drawn over all the windows. The enormous marble-topped table that dominated the room was lit by overhead lamps, the wash of their light thrown up on the five members, two of them women, sitting around it. To judge by the clutter of bottles, glasses, and overfilled ashtrays, and the brooding, weary faces, they had been debating for many hours. Bloxham poured himself a glass of water and took his place. There was one empty seat. Godolphin's. Dowd was not invited to occupy it, but stood at the end of the table, mildly discomfited by the stares of his interrogators. Not one face among them would have been known by the populace at large. Though all of them had descended from families of wealth and influence, these were not public powers. The society forbade any member to hold office or take as a spouse an individual who might invite or arouse the curiosity of the press. It worked in mystery for the demise of mystery. Perhaps it was that paradox, more than any other aspect of its nature, which would finally undo it. At the other end of the table from Dowd, sitting in front of a heap of newspapers, doubtless carrying the Burke reports, sat a professorial man in his 60s, white hair oiled to his scalp. Dowd knew his name from Godolphin's description, Hubert Shales, dubbed the Sloth by Oscar. He moved and spoke with the caution of a glass-boned theologian.
"You know why you're here?" he said.
"He knows," Bloxham put in.
"Some problem with Mr. Godolphin," Dowd ventured.
"He's not here,"
said one of the women to Dowd's right, her face emaciated beneath a confection of dyed black hair. Alice Tirrett, Dowd guessed.
"That's the problem."
"So I see," Dowd said.
"Where the hell is he?"
Bloxham demanded.
"He's travelling," Dowd replied. "I don't think he anticipated a meeting."
"Neither did we,"
said Lionel Wakeman, flushed with the scotch he'd imbibed, the bottle lying in the crook of his arm.
"Where's he travelling?" Tirrett asked. "It's imperative we find him."
"I'm afraid I don't know," Dowd said. "His business takes him all over the world."
"Anything respectable?" Wakeman slurred.
"He's got a number of investments in Singapore," Dowd replied, "and in India. Would you like me to prepare a dossier? I'm sure he'd be..."
"Bugger the dossier," Bloxham said. "We want him here, now."
"I'm afraid I don't know his precise whereabouts. Somewhere in the Far East."
The severe